Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the tailgate podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, you just said it. We could have had a nothing burger of a college lacrosse weekend, and we got anything but. What a weekend it is that we've got to discuss.
And I keep going back in these circles where I'm like, every year I say, have we had this exciting of a year in college lacrosse ever? And this year in particular, number one seed cursed. Every single matchup is like, I just looked at the slate of games and I was calling a Seals game this weekend and I'm like, oh, how are we going to make this one entertaining? And then tracking the games, I'm like, oh my God, how are we going to fit all of this into the episode? We're really going to piss off a couple fan bases because they had some marquee wins and that's seventh on the list. So it's one of those seasons, to use every overused term, throw out the record books, throw out, you know, who the favorites, throw out the odds, because every game is providing value and every weekend there are a couple ridiculous games that make me legitimately excited to come on and talk to my good friend Terry about said and aforementioned games.
I mean, you said it, and I think so the overused trope that I don't want to lean into is March Madness, right? In terms of, it's March Madness. College basketball is happening. You and I have consumed next to none of it for similar but different reasons. Obviously, you're traveling to call a professional lacrosse game. I was watching a lot of college lacrosse. But the I do want to like kind of frame out my day on Saturday because I think it helps relative to understanding like how we're going to construct this podcast. And now that I say that, I'm actually going to go all the way back to Friday. So I decided to go to a high school game. I wanted to check out Western Reserve Academy, which is a top 25 program from Northeast Ohio. I'm close with Dylan Sheridan. I played against Western Reserve when I was in high school. So they were playing at Gilman. So I went to that game, froze my ass off, and then came home just in time to see the start of Boston University versus Army, which is a significant result that we are going to end this podcast with because of my, what did you call it? Anti-recency bias?
Your formerly bias?
Yeah, my formerly bias.
It's
yeah.
Like, oh,
that doesn't
well,
make any
you know,
sense, but sure.
That game was, well, it's like, you know, what's the opposite of recent?
Right.
Like,
former. Yeah. Old. My oldest biased. I mean, I'm an ageist when it comes to games.
Your best game of the year on Friday. God forbid it's on a Wednesday. Terry's like, oh, who cares?
We're legit not going to talk about Syracuse 10, Duke 4. So yeah, see ya. Best defensive performance of the season. That being said, so Saturday, because of this like storm that blew through the Northeast, Yale Cornell got moved from noon to two. And so I'd already kind of planned on watching on one screen Princeton, Harvard, and on the other Yale Cornell. So that actually opened up perfectly for me. But what it also did in a negative way was it kind of made Carolina High Point like a little bit of like a unrealized game because Yale Cornell ended at four and Carolina High Point started at three. So it was really only like middle of the third quarter that I started to actually notice that, you know, what had been roughly a four goal game, let's just say, when I was checking it on the scoreboard over the course of the game, had actually started to tighten up a little bit. So Nikki, that's where we're going to start. Are you ready to get us going?
Yes, I am. Let's roll. And it, like the two program firsts, Boston gets their first win over a number one program ever. But the game of the week, and I mean, my goodness, the Junkyard Scrappy Dog Award of the Week presented by Skyline Chili is going to High Point, who got their first ever victory over North Carolina in just a terrific game. Final score being 12-11 in overtime. And
nope, not overtime, regulation.
Or regulation, sorry. Bad note. Good start, Nick. And to your point, High Point never really looked like they were going to do anything. They had deficits over the course of the game, 5-0, 9-3, and 11-5. UNC was able to kind of nurture that early lead that they jumped out to, but they ended up scoring the last seven of the game, starting with 1 minute and 16 seconds left in the third quarter. So many cool storylines. First one that I want to jump into is John Torpy beating his former coach, which is always cool because he played under Bresci. And we can talk about the game a very balanced attack because they had nine players. High Point had nine players registering a goal. And also UNC had eight. It was a good balanced attack from both sides. And we just have to start because with time winding down, the cockiest, the most egregious, scumbag, greasy, who do you think you are? Maiea throws a disgustingly accurate behind-the-back pass to Jack Sawyer, who does a pirouette tap dance. Who do you think you are? What kind of sport are you playing? This ain't ballet, son. Turning, hits the shovel shot with seconds on the clock to launch High Point into their first victory. Terry, I've seen a number of game-winning goals. Every one of them is exciting because you kind of have that palpable energy. Are we going to see a goal or are we not? The balls that you have to have and the confidence that you have to not only just throw that pass, but instead of trying to get that, all right, everybody shoot overhand and bury it low corner. Nah. I'm going to throw a backhand shovel pass. The clip went viral in the most justified viral clip that I've seen in my, you know, last 5 years. And it's the best game-ending goal of the season. There's not going to be a better one. Terry, High Point gets their first victory in program history over UNC.
Yeah, so, I mean, you touched on a lot there, and there's still more to get to. You kind of glossed over the fact that, I mean, you said it, but you kind of glossed over the fact that High Point scored the last seven goals of this game, right? So, you know, you can look at it from both points of view if you're a Carolina fan and say, like, man, we just needed one more stop, or, man, we just needed one more goal. But obviously, if you're looking at it from a High Point point of view, and this is where John Torpy really kind of started to give credit, like the face-off unit and the way that they battled, and it wasn't really even their number one guy. I can't attest to having been following the Panthers so closely as to know the balance between Colin Hoban and Luca Acaruna, I believe is how you say his name. But you know, in my memory or my like concept of this team, Colin Hoban is kind of he's been the number one face-off guy. So, you know, to have that level of, you know, two-headed nature to this was very impressive. But on top of that, I mean, I shifted my focus solely onto this game with about halfway through the fourth quarter. And that was when they really started to chip away. But at the same time, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that, you know, they were going to be able to close the gap all of the way. And so that's what led to a pretty dramatic game tying goal. And then ultimately, you're right. I mean, the fact that coming out of a timeout with 30 seconds left-ish to have a player who's, you know, your best player make a play like that, throw a behind-the-back pass to sickening, an unbelievable finish, is just an incredible way to win a game. And we've got him. Braden Maiea, High Point attackman, game-winning assist against North Carolina to win this. Congratulations, Braden. Can you tell us what was going through your mind when you threw that pass?
Yeah, appreciate that. Thanks for having me. Honestly, coach just drew up the play, and I knew it was coming to me, and I had that sweep over the top. And honestly, once we got on the field and came out of the huddle, my teammate Jack Sawyer, he just looked at me. He just goes, "Mayo." He gave me that look, and I was like, all right, I'm going to throw him this. So I just knew I had to figure out a way to get him that ball, and I mean, he did the rest. He made an unreal finish, and yeah, it was huge for us.
So, you know, just in terms of this, High Point has been a giant killer over the course of the last roughly decade. Wins over Virginia, wins over Duke. But do you guys think of Carolina differently for either of the two reasons? One being you hadn't beaten them before, and the other being, like, it's the University of North Carolina and your college is in North Carolina. Do either of those things matter relative to how you approach this game?
I would say we kind of prepare for this game like we prepare for any other game.
Right.
Well, I mean, hey, we always go out there, put our best foot forward. Obviously, watch the scout on those guys. Coach Torpy, Coach Kenny, Coach Shakey, they all really dive into that and give us the answers in the film room and on the field leading up. So they're able to give us the adjustments that we needed to make on the field. And, yeah, just our ability to be able to execute that obviously showed in the game. So it was really good to have that.
Yeah. I have a quick question. Who do you think you are Because that was the best pass that I've ever seen in my entire life. So sick, man. Thanks for joining us. And a legitimate question here, because sometimes I was a part of a couple comebacks at Notre Dame, and Coach Corrigan would draw up a play. And kind of like what you just said, it was, all right, let's just give each other the nod. I don't know what Coach just drew up. Let's just go out there and do what we know how to do. So during that nod that Sawyer gave you, did you just completely disregard the offensive set, or was that kind of part of the structure that led to the goal?
It was actually part of the structure.
Good man.
Because I'm coming across the top for a sweep, and it's either I'm shooting it or it's always a look to him. But, you know, once he gave me that nod, I was like, I guess I'm not shooting this. I'm passing him the ball. So, yeah.
And can you just take me into the locker room after the game? So there were a couple different factors. Obviously, and Terry and I haven't discussed the pregame speech that you received, but it weighs heavily into the emotion. So can you just take us through kind of what that pregame speech meant to you, and even give it some context, because this is the first time we're bringing it up in discussion, and then what that meant for you after the game? Because of all the postgame locker rooms, getting a program first victory in such a greasy, disgusting way had to have been pretty electric.
Yeah. So obviously we had Mr. Bear, Tyler Bear's dad, come in. He suffered from a heart attack. He was skiing in Colorado, and there was some, like, he only had a, whatever, I think it was like 17% chance of living. So he came in, and he just told us, you know, don't take a moment for granted, because, you know, everything goes by really quickly. So just hearing him say that kind of just made us all lock in and get fired up for the game. And, like, being a senior now, I'm like, hey, this is my last time I could be playing against these guys. I'm going to give it everything I got. And I know that's what my teammates did as well. And then, yeah, being able to go out and execute and coming back in the locker room after, I mean, it was just electric. Guys were jumping all over each other, spraying water. You know, it was just a really feel-good moment, one that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life.
So, Braden, when I talked to Coach Torpy after the game, the very first place he started was – Braden Maia and Jack Van Overbeek are pros. They're D1 All-Americans. They're pros. They can play in both pro leagues if they want to. One of the things that intrigues me so much about your game is the first half of your career, you were kind of best known as being the guy who finished all Asher Nolting's feeds. And then over the course of the last 2 years, you know, the player that I've seen you become is a combination of, you know, a lot more of a ball-carrying initiator. And then really more than kind of all those things, and this isn't differentiated between, you know, the first couple years and the more recent times, but like you're a tenacious, tenacious rider. How do you describe your game? How do you think about kind of the future for you lacrosse-wise? Do you want to play pro lacrosse?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to play in the PLL, the NLL. Both leagues, that'd be, it's been a goal of mine since I was little, so definitely would want to do that. But yeah, as far as my game goes, obviously, more of an inside guy my freshman year, and then started to get more comfortable as I started to actually play more field lacrosse, because coming from box, it was a little bit of a transition there. But, yeah, getting more comfortable and just going out and doing the extra work on my own time with my teammates, really helped me a lot, just to give me that confidence and being able to dodge and draw some attention from other guys to get some other inside guys open. So
this isn't like the most normal lacrosse podcast. Like, we tend to, you know, stay within some guardrails, but every once in a while we venture beyond them, and this is going to be one of those times. So your nickname is Mayo for obvious reasons. Your last name is Maia. Mayo is a very divisive condiment. Some people love it, some people hate it. Do you eat mayo?
I actually don't eat mayo.
Do you like find it disgusting and you judge everybody who does?
Like, let's say like we get Jersey Mike's or something and there's like mayo on the sub, like I'll eat it, but I won't like go out of my way to like order mayo on a sandwich.
Nick, do you eat mayo?
I mean, yeah. I'm like, yeah, load it up. And I think if you don't like mayo, you're a toddler and a child. And so,
Or a Canadian,
yeah. Which is essentially a toddler and a child. So two things. One, I'm a broadcaster for the Seals. You want me to put in a good word for them? It's just a 45% of your contract, your first year contract, which is a low fee. I'd be happy to put in a good word with head coach Patrick Merrill. And a bit of a stupid question here, but I work with a face-off guy, Crew Nelson, here in Idaho, Boise, Idaho, and he actually committed to High Point. And so I've gotten to know Coach Torpy a little bit better than I have over the last year or so. Any words of wisdom for this freshman class incoming? Because one of the things that Coach Corrigan always said is they're going to be following kind of the tone that you set as a senior. And now that tone is we're the top dogs in North Carolina. Wise words for Idaho players that are going to be attending High Point.
Yeah, this is actually something that a senior guy said to me when I was coming in as a freshman. He said, find the hardest working guy in your town and make him look like he's lazy. So whatever it is, you know, get that extra run in, get that extra lift in. Always be doing more, always be doing extra work just to make yourself better and you being in shape when you come in here.
Incredible words. I think it helps to steer clear away from the Mayo in order to be able to be the best and most in shape guy when you arrive in High Point, North Carolina. Braden, congratulations on the win, man. It was awesome. It was so exciting. It was so much fun to watch. Before we let you get out of here, one of the things that I want to start doing is giving our guests an opportunity to shout out some of their teammates or coaches. And you already did shout out Coach Torpy and Coach Kenny and Coach Shakey for their role in the win. But who are some of the other guys whose performances you felt like were really instrumental to beating the Tar Heels?
Yeah, obviously I'll start off with Luke Arcardo, the faceoff guy. He came up huge for us. I think he won like, I don't know what percent it was, but over 50%, which was huge for us. Another guy, Jack Van Overbeck, he's the quarterback of our offense. He's a great guy on and off the field, one of my best friends. He is able to just feed the ball, and his ability to score too is off the charts. So shout out to him too. And then I'll also give one to Sawyer, obviously, for scoring that last goal.
Awesome. Anybody you want to chirp? Any kind of daggers you want to throw on this public platform?
Okay,
good. Good job.
All right. Well, Braden, we'll let you get back to your Sunday. We really appreciate you joining the podcast, and we can't wait to watch the Panthers back in action as you guys get going with the A-10 play. This is when the real season starts.
Yeah, right in the conference. We appreciate you guys having me. Thank you.
What a good kid.
That's a beauty.
So obviously you're listening to this, but when I said Canadians are essentially toddlers or whatever it was, he just shook his head and smiled. And I was like, there, we cracked him, because he was a little formal coming into it. And I was like, how do I crack this kid?
Yeah, he was wearing the High Point polo.
Yeah. I was like, that's a well-trained SID for High Point. Good job.
That's probably the problem, is that we over-index on guests for programs that have good SIDs, because it's hard to book kids on Sundays given the performance that they just had the day prior. So if the SID is going to be able to pull it off, that probably means they're good enough at training these kids in the media training sessions that they're just, you know, not going to drop F-bombs or, you know, tell stories about the celebration party.
Well, and I got to say, like, you know, thank God I had other players that were way better than I was, because if somebody asked me, like, yeah, do you want to throw any daggers? I would have just started going, oh, my God, you know, Jack Neer thinks he's so good, you know, Sergio, but like, I just love the banter. And I probably would have said something very mean out of context or directly in context, thinking it was funny. And then I would have had another meeting and been like, sorry, coach, my bad.
That's so. The last time you get invited onto a podcast. Or yeah. Not invited, but allowed to go onto a podcast.
Yeah. Great guy. I'm rooting for him now. I really like that.
Score update, 8-6, 8-7 Hopkins over Rutgers, 2:41 to go.
Ooh, at the time of writing, it was 8-3 or 7-3. So 7-3, that game's creeping back. Watch out. So, again, shout-out High Point. First win over UNC. The Battle of the Carolinas certainly heating up. Going to be fun to watch. And we'll see if High Point can continue their streak of, little David action.
There you go.
Biblical reference for you kids at home. So, moving on, Michigan and Maryland. Michigan wins 12-11 in the second-best 12-11 game of the week. Terry, I don't know if you ever watched the hit show My Strange Addiction.
Kind of
a weird one. But this is episode 3, because Michigan is quite frankly addicted to beating Maryland. And this was the most exciting game of the three-game run that Michigan has had. And it was a close slugfest the entire time. So Michigan jumped out early, but it was pretty much a 1-2 goal game for the duration. And credit to Michigan's midfield, who initiated hard and dodged all day. I know a couple of their players kind of shout out the Michigan offensive midfield unit. And they can take credit. And it was actually Justin Tiernan who had 5 goals on the day that said that in the post game. And Maryland had a balanced offensive performance, and it kind of felt like it was an even matchup from just about every standpoint. And in another game where the last goal was just, you know, kind of a gong show, it wasn't nearly as pretty, but it was just as exciting. Well, not just as exciting, but it was exciting as well. Logan McEnany made a save, and it was a ground ball scrum in front of the net. Maryland initially had possession, but it was one of those, they have possession and they're kind of surrounded by the Michigan attack unit. So it wasn't a clear possession. And I thought it kind of had shades of Cornell from last week, where I was like, let's just see another pole come down and score. Let's just make that a weekly theme. Instead of that happening, the ball was checked out of the stick. Now, the ball can go in any different direction. I don't know if Michigan said some prayers before the game, but as that ball was checked out of the stick, you couldn't have asked for a better trajectory leaving Maryland's stick. It goes right into Tiernan's stick. He had to scoop it up off the ground, who diving crease goal buried it in front of the net. So with about, I think it was about 1 minute and change left, diving, flags down. The refs kind of took a second. We were going to say, all right, this is going to be one of those situations where the refs may or may not decide the impact of the game. And it's important to note that the Big Ten decided that they're not going to have replay review. So the entire game, to an extent, hinged on this call after a couple exciting momentum building seconds. Referees put their hand up, ball game. Terry, Michigan beats Maryland again.
Yeah, so you said when you were describing the High Point game winner that it was like the game winner, the best game winner that you can remember in whatever, you know, period of time. Like, for me, it was like that Tiernan goal might have been one of the most dramatic game winners if it hadn't, and it stood the test of time for like an hour and a half before it got replaced by Braden Maia's BTB. I mean, this what was even more crazy about the way this game unfolded is, you've done this show with me long enough to know that I tend not to use definitive statements, right? Like I you know, I'm a middleman guy, whatever.
You like the nuance.
Exactly. Daniel Maltz scored an unbelievable catch between his feet, one motion spinning finish that either tied the game or put Maryland ahead one. And then moments later, he scored again to just extend the situation. And at that point, in our group chat, I said, game over. Maryland's going to win this. You cannot recover from how impressive that performance was. And it turned out not to be true. So when I look at the combination of exactly how, what's the right word? Courageous, I think, is the word I'm going for. The play was from Justin Tiernan in terms of dive bombing the crease and goal mouth and then converting that. And then also to, you know, rewind back like 6, 7, 8 minutes, whatever the case may be. And the resilience that Michigan showed, right? In terms of, you know, it wasn't about building a lead and holding on. It was about being involved in a punch counter punch situation and making it happen, making that victory happen. It was remarkable and very impressive. And, you know, again, we've talked about upsets in the over the course of the last couple of weeks in terms of the context of things. This, there was nothing fluky about this. This was very sustainable when it comes to Michigan's performance. Now, I think that there's a lot about matchups. We're going to talk about this in the context of BU versus Army later in the show. It's hard not to pay close attention to how these teams match up against each other in terms of what it actually means. But with that being said, yeah, just an impressive, impressive showing from Michigan. And yeah, that, you know, it's been brought up a few times, but I think it's the accurate point. The only thing that was different about Michigan's season in 2020 2023 versus 2024 was that loss to Harvard. Everything else leading up to this week was the same. But it didn't seem like the vibe was the same. But I think that's because the preseason expectations for this year relative to last year, coming off of the quarterfinal versus not making the NCAA tournament, that was the distinction, right? So Michigan isn't in exactly the same position to do what they did last year again this year. There is nothing standing in their way. They just have to seize the moment going forward. The notion that they were a quarterfinal team, I think, meant in a lot of people's minds, like, you know, this team should be in the top eight, if not, then certainly the top 12 all year long. Well, they haven't been, right? Like, you know, they've been borderline top 20 team so far. I'm very, very interested in how the votes are going to fall from like 17 to 22, 23. You know, a lot of the teams that were in that mix last week, like Quinnipiac and Towson and some of the others that weren't, you know, whatever, included in the top 20, like they won, so they're in the mix. Then you have to consider High Point based on that win over North Carolina in this resume. You probably have to consider Carolina falling out, but certainly Michigan bolstered their situation as well, and then so did BU. So that 17 to 23 range and cluster is really interesting, and kind of figuring out how to figuring out how to order the entire thing is going to be insane, but that specific situation is going to be really interesting as far as how the cards fall.
Well, and going back to that original point, like, not all goals are created equal. Like, from the player perspective, the best player that I think we ever played against in college was Jordan Wolfe. And I'll even throw Zach Miller. That boy fast. Oh, I hated it. And I'll throw Zach Miller. What's up?
Did you ever get like switched onto him?
Yeah, I did once in college and a couple times in the pros, and that I literally say, like, the highlight of my career is I guarded one of his dodges from X and caused a turnover, and it was a fluke, and I think he just dropped it, but I'm like, yeah, you know, let's go. We killed the Rattlers that day. But going back to that kind of player perspective that you were talking about, where Maltz scores two unbelievable goals. Not all goals are created equal in the sense of how you can come back from that as a player. And the reason why I brought up Wolf and Zach Miller in particular, because those two guys were essentially the Notre Dame killers while I was on the roster. And granted, it, you know, two unbelievable players, but when they would score a goal late in the game, it just became a more defeated, a more, holy shit, like, how are we going to stop that? And so I want to give extra props to Michigan on top of the ones that you've already given them, saying, like, you watch a player like Maltz uncork two pretty ridiculous goals towards the end of the game. You have two choices. That can take the wind out of your sails, or you can scrap back your way from that. And while this was a big win and a program, you know, momentum building win, I think that will take it kind of to the next level and give Michigan more momentum than you might think, having come off a big win for Maryland because of the fashion that they did it, and knowing, having been on those sidelines, having those players that can make ridiculous plays against you, you know, that player psychology is a very real thing. And I've been in a huddle after Jordan Wolfe scored a ridiculous goal, and we just go, okay, like, what, do we just lose this game? Like, what the hell are we supposed to do? So credit to Michigan, and I think that's a great point that they can leverage if they find themselves down, if they play an unbelievable player who's having a hot day, and watch out for the Wolverines. Good for them.
Yeah, they head to Hopkins next week. I think that Justin Wiefeld is a player that we have to shout out as well. He finished with 15 of 24 and picked up 10 ground balls, you know, tilted the possession advantage. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about Luke Wehrman and the job that if you can do that, if you can go 63% against Luke Wehrman, you put in a solid day's work.
That's a little, bring your lunch pail, 63%. So moving on to a game today, and we'll preface it by, yes, we're not going to get to Duke Syracuse. Okay, so everybody put your pitchforks down. Syracuse played good. Duke lost 10-4 to Syracuse. after 4 days. So it was kind of a back-to-back Syracuse midweek and then DU today. That is a tough two-game stretch. Duke does a great job rebounding. They end up beating the Pioneers 11-7. And I'm not even really going to talk about that much because you were allegedly at the game.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was kind of why I wanted to talk about it, because obviously this Duke team is a lightning rod. I don't know. That might be too strong of a word. But I also want to make one other point, which is that so it's been 3 weeks since Duke has had a full, like, 7-day preparation. They played Loyola on March 9th, Providence on March 13th, Richmond on March 16th, Syracuse on Wednesday, and then Denver on Sunday. And it'll be another, I mean, they host BU on Wednesday. So then they get 10 days off before resuming ACC action when they host the Notre Dame Fighting Irish on April 7th. So point being that they're nearing the end of a pretty ridiculous sprint. So I think that it's kind of tough. The first thing is Brendan O'Neill is pretty clearly suffering from a hamstring issue. He kind of came out and came back in the first quarter. It didn't affect things necessarily. He scored the second goal of the game on a nice dive. He had another nice dive that I think was maybe the sixth goal of the game. And then he scored the empty net goal with that was the 11th goal. And that you know, kind of was his stat line for the day. Just, you know, something that bears watching relative to a combination of his production and what it means for Duke going forward. It was 4-1 at halftime. So you can look at that both ways. You can say four goals against Syracuse, what's wrong with Duke's offense? Even kind of 12 goals against Richmond, but not really, because Richmond was the number one defense coming into that game. So, you know, putting up 12 and holding Richmond to three, like, they didn't need to score more in order to win. So I really look at it as like a three-half, a six-quarter problem. But the other side of the coin was they held Denver's offense to one. And so I think that we need to start with the performance that Duke's defense put in. Kenny Brower is an absolute animal. And if you're working on your PLL draft board or whatever the case may be, I mean, this kid athletically has something that not a lot and maybe no other players in college lacrosse have. The combination of strength, physicality, and ferocity. I mean, he is just an MF-er on ball. And it, you know,
what does that stand for?
I don't want to get the explicit tag on the podcast, so allow me to censor myself.
Okay.
But it's just the only word for it. You know what I mean? Like, and you know exactly why I use it. It's because of, like he's the type of player that, like, if you're an attackman, you tell your mom not to watch that game if you're going to be guarded by him. He's going to do terrible things to you. It reminds me of Michael Evans. I don't know. Did you ever play with him? Was he out of the league by the time you got in?
No, I actually almost got in a fight with him the first scrimmage on the Bayhawks because I dodged him and I was like, okay, so you're just Barry Bonds today? Like, what are you doing? Yeah, he's an MF-er.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
Ask your parents, kids. So that was kind of the first thing. But the second thing is that I think proliferated over the course of the entire offense, particularly in the first half. It just felt like Denver had nowhere to turn where they were going to be able to find their athletic advantages. And we've talked about that in the context of this offense the entire season. I thought that, you know, Michael Lampert over the course of the game showed the ability to get separation a little bit better. Joshua Carlson had two nice takes that led to goals as well. But it was really just kind of like once they started to play with a little bit more urgency that Denver was able to start to actually put goals on the board. I thought Patrick Jamison played fine. I didn't think he was great. I really thought that it was Duke's defensive performance that won them the game and kind of set the tone for the game. The question becomes, how much of Duke's offensive stagnancy was a function of the fact that they weren't really pushed? And the reason that I ask it that way is because when they did get pushed, they responded. So, you know, if Denver kind of turned a 7-4 lead into a 7-6 lead, then Duke would respond with a pair of goals to push it back out to 9-6. And so I use the expression playing with your food in this context, and I know coaches hate it because it suggests this kind of like laissez-faire, unserious attitude that is exactly the opposite of what they want their players to play with. And I get it, but I do think it's also one of the best expressions to kind of communicate the point I'm trying to make with respect to, like just essentially not playing with urgency, right? Like if you've ever seen a kid play with his food in a meal, it's like he'll eventually eat probably, I don't know, but he's just not that hungry right now, or he doesn't care that much or whatever. And that's kind of the way that I feel when I watch some of these teams and you just look at them and you're like, you can be scoring more goals, but you aren't. And I can't really pinpoint a particular reason why. I thought that there was one moment midway through the fourth quarter, maybe that was closer to like, let's say 4 minutes left, something like that, maybe a little bit under three, when there was about 30 seconds left on the shot clock and Andrew McAdory threw the ball into the corner. And we asked John Donowski after the game, like, what happened there? What was the nature of the miscommunication that led to that? Because they ended up keeping the ball in bounds and then called a timeout. And so he kind of talked through their terminology and what the miscommunication was from the sideline. And you can look at it and say, like, it was a very, like, insignificant play. But you can also look at it and say, like, that is an example of whatever is just not meshing perfectly right now for Duke's offense. And I point out all these midweek games, not to say that, I mean, first of all, like Duke is probably tired. They are probably a little bit more injured because they haven't been able to dedicate the amount of time to rest and recovery as they otherwise would. But also, like, they're not benefiting from, you know, they're basically, so they play, they have a recovery day, they have a prep for the game day, and then they have a travel day with a walkthrough. Like, that's what it's been for their last five games. Whereas, when you have 6 days in between games, you have a day off, and then you have, or who knows, like, every team, you know, kind of plots their days off differently. But let's just say, all right, let's say you have a recovery day, then a day off, and then you have a focus on us day, and then you have a high-intensity focus on us day, and then you have a game prep day, and then you have pregame. Right? They haven't had either of those focus on us or intense focus on us days in a month. Whereas, you know, they've played, what, 11 games, I think? Most teams have played, I mean, Yale's played five. Like, most teams are in that 6, 7, 8 game range. Duke has 4 games left, and one of them is on Wednesday. So, I mean, that, not counting the ACC tournament. So starting on Thursday through the last weekend of the regular season, they're going to have 3 games, including 2 bye weeks. So not only are they going to have, like, at least, you know, 1 day off, they're going to have a couple weeks where they get multiple days off, and then they're also going to have, like, potentially 2 weeks where it's only focusing on us. So only saying that to say, I came away from this Duke win over Denver. Denver, very good team. They were 6-1 coming in. Huge RPI boost for the Blue Devils. Important game. If you just watched this game in isolation, you would have come away unimpressed and said Duke is not a serious national championship contender. My point overall is to caution against that. So that's my take on the Blue Devils.
Well, and I guess, first off, what a ridiculously good analysis right there. And I've said it before, and I don't know if I've said it on this podcast, but your ability to take a ridiculous amount of lacrosse knowledge and condense it into a digestible, you know, 2 to 3, whatever minute, you know, speech, that was very impressive.
That's not the nicest thing you've said to me about me in the last, like, hour. Do you want to tell the audience what you said after I sent you a Bugs Bunny meme?
You don't get enough credit for actually being funny. So I gotta figure out some ways to bring you back down. With that being said, it's interesting because I was actually catching up, and I'd like to formally apologize on a public platform to Jamie Iketa, former Duke defenseman. It was his bachelor party this weekend. Case Mathias out there, Greg Rhodes out there, Jamie Iketa out there. I couldn't make it because I was calling a Seals game. Public apology to Jamie Iketa and the Duke alumni that I would have just loved to have talked a bunch of crap to all weekend. And one of the, you know, when you're starting to know, we met on the Outlaws and you just kind of talk about you essentially just get around and complain about who had the worst coach, who said the meanest thing, which coach treated you the worst. It's kind of like this rite of passage. And then you get past that and you actually kind of talk nitty gritty. And it was interesting because he always made the point where it was like, oh my God, like he just overloaded us early in the season. Like you wonder why we always drop a couple games in February. And he accredited it to kind of two things. One, was more of a skill development than an X's and O's development. So the tendency to potentially be sloppy between the lines, not really have a good dialed in offense X's and O's wise, which leads them to be, you know, upset susceptible as the storyline has gone over the course of the year. And then he would also just say, like, yeah, and knowing that we had a lot of games front loaded was a toll and a tax on the body. And contrast that with Coach Corrigan, who we always felt ran the tightest ship for preseason conditioning. Like, we loathed coming into preseason every year because we knew it was going to be so hard. But when was the last time Notre Dame dropped a bad game in February or March? No, we would tee off on a Detroit Mercy or a Cleveland State or one of those first games that we saw happen early in the season. So again, every time I see Duke, you know, regardless of their season, but that structured schedule, giving them time off to fully heal. They've had so much experience. There's so much film to watch. There's so much to catch up on. And now they have the game experience, which just boosted the player development that Danowski set up. Watch out for the Blue Devils. I'm very excited to see how they match up against Notre Dame. And quickly, I kind of want to ask you just about Denver in general. So they've dropped two of their last three, a two-goal loss to Yale, and then obviously this loss to Duke, but they have wins over, you know, Hopkins, Cornell. Where do you see the Pios stacking up? Because it sounded like what you were accrediting Duke to was just a better physical presence. Does DU have the ability at all to overcome that athleticism of a Duke, of a Virginia, et cetera?
So, I mean, I hesitate to, 92% of my brain wants to say, no, they don't have the ability to overcome that. So first of all, let me say a bunch of really nice things about Denver. I don't understand how you could think that they haven't exceeded expectations. They have. So first and foremost, number two, their RPI is number 9. It will probably stay roughly there. Villanova's is 13. Georgetown's is 14. I'm sure, you know, some of the other Big East opponents are going to weigh that down a little bit. But obviously, that's also true for the other teams. You know, it's all relative, right? So the other teams that are around there. So, you know, if they are in that 8, 9, 10 range, they're an at-large, not locked, but they're likely in as an at-large team. If they win the Big East, you know, and they stay in that 8, 9 range, like, they're probably going to host. So, that being said, I don't really see them having the ability, even if they went out, to get that much higher, maybe 6, right? But probably not 5. And then conversely, you know, certainly they have games that are droppable that if they do drop them, they, you know, would be on the outside of the tournament. So they are not a lock. That being said, this point in the year, you have to say, like, they've exceeded expectations. They've played really well. Here's what it comes down to. If you are going to overcome an athletic disadvantage against a more athletic opponent, especially when it's your offense against their defense,
you need Canadians.
Yes, and they have a lot of them, but what you really need is everything to go well. You can't have a bad day. If you are the more athletic offense against a less athletic defense, and you have a bad day and you're losing by 3 late in the game, you can just put the ball in one guy's stick and say, go get it. And he might be able to do it. That's not what's available to you when you're a team who thrives off of ball movement, creativity, off-ball action, really good range shooting, and that is what this team is. So my point is they are good, and there are matchups. There are, like, NCAA tournament first round, maybe even quarterfinal matchups where they can just play straight up. They can play their game. Things don't have to go well, and they can win, right? I don't think Duke, Notre Dame, and Virginia are three of them. I think that in order to beat those three teams, they need to have a good day. And that's not a criticism. It's not a knock. It's just it's my opinion. And it's, frankly, like a very... Of course, it's almost like an obvious statement to me, you know? It's like, there aren't that many teams that can beat those three without having a good day.
Well taken.
Do you accept it?
Yeah, no, I accept it. Just, you know, for you to be so mean and brutal and spiteful to Denver is honestly sad. Corrupt journalism is what we're seeing. So, moving on. Princeton, Harvard. So Ivy League starting to take a little bit of shape. And it essentially was another hard-fought loss for Harvard. And there's a little bit of clarity to kind of the conference hierarchy. And what was interesting is it was a pretty even game for most of it, but ultimately it was Princeton that was able to pull away. And we've had Coach Byrne on this podcast. I feel like Harvard is arguably one of the teams that we know better, given that relationship, not only with Coach Byrne being my former coach, but Harvard being a consistent talking point here. And Nate Kibiri made some interesting comments. So he had the last three goals for Princeton, and he had five on the day. But he was quick to give credit to what he was saying was a difference maker in Coulter Mackesy as the guy who kind of draws so much attention that gives other guys opportunities. But in his post-game interview, I thought it was interesting to say that he knew Harvard was going to hedge and that quick ball movement was key. And that turned out to be pretty true, you know, in the last quarter of the game. So we'll talk about that more here in a second. But it was the usual suspects for Harvard. Sam King, Logan Ipp, and Teddy Malone accounted for a majority of Harvard's offense. But, you know, in the portfolio management, who would you rather have matchup of the week? It was Princeton ultimately coming away with a three-goal win. Terry, what do you got?
So I mentioned that, you know, this was the game that I was focused on in the early part of Saturday. And I chose it because after seeing Harvard, Yale, and Princeton Cornell on Saturday and Sunday, and obviously we digested those the week prior on last week's tailgate, I feel like Yale and Cornell are the two most athletic teams. They're the two most physical teams. I think that Penn, Princeton, and Harvard are similar in terms of how skilled they are offensively. And I think the outlier unit on those teams is Penn's defense. And I think that, you know, if you watched the Penn Duke game, you would have seen that in terms of how physical they are defensively, but then offensively, you know, they haven't been as productive as the other four teams and certainly as Princeton and Harvard. So I frame that way to say that I came into this game with the loosest feel for how it was going to unfold. And that's what made me most intrigued by it. And through three quarters, it was 9-9. And when you watch a game through the lens that I watch it through, what I'm trying to discern is what is the story of this game? And sometimes the story is 60 minutes. Sometimes the story is the context of the season to that point or the season going forward, whatever. Like in order to do this job effectively, I think you got to come up with something that helps the audience understand what this means in a larger context, whether, again, it might be about the tactics of the 60 minutes. It might be about one player's performance in 15 minutes, which is what I think this game kind of came down to. And that was why I really isolated, you know, I wanted to talk to Nate Kibiri. I wanted to get a sense for how that, you know, fourth quarter unfolded for him and what it felt like. And to your point about how deferential he was to Coulter, you know, it's not surprising in that kind of junior freshman dynamic, of course. I think it's pretty clear, right, that there's a lineage being formed here where it'll be Kibiri's responsibility to take the baton from Maxey when he's done in terms of that offensive initiator, because he has that skill set both from the standpoint of dodging and distributing. Your point about and really isolating what it meant for how they were supposed to attack Harvard defensively is intriguing. We talked 2 weeks ago about how matchup conscious Harvard is with Jerry Byrne and how matchup conscious they aren't and what that means. And then obviously, you know, they kind of, and this is the element, right? Like there are some, he talked about the need to evolve and playing picks against Michigan was one of the elements of that. But one of the things that I think will, it's a principle that can't evolve is, you know, the 7-man unit and the 6 runners. I don't even know if that's the right term for it. I think it's probably the term in skaters. Would it be the term in hockey? Runners would be the term in soccer. They always live in the gray, right? And Jerry Byrne's defenses, it's always about like the 6-person collective has to be more important than any individual one-on-one matchup. And when you live in the gray, what I mean by that is if you can guard 2 people off ball, then awesome. If you can guard 3 people off ball, even better, right? Get me back on track if I'm getting astray based on being incorrect on how you were taught the Byrne method. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is, all right, that means that the value of beating your guy straight up is lower because you're always going to have half to 33%, 50 to 33% attention of the other guys off ball. And so you're not going to get as far. But what it also means is that if you are off ball, then you have to be able to take advantage of the fact that you're not getting 100% of the attention of the guy who's guarding you, right? And that's, I think, what I took from his comments, even though he scored those three fourth quarter goals were in very different contexts. One was on extra man, one was dodging, and one was finishing an assisted goal. And so, but the point is that you got to be prepared for it. And one of the elements of being not matchup conscious is that you kind of put the pressure on the opponent to be more versatile in terms of the things that they ask you to do. Because if you're playing everybody straight up, then everybody can kind of, I don't want to say sag, but like kind of sink into their roles, right? Like, I'm the off-ball finisher, I'm the dodger, I'm the passer, I'm the lever man, whatever the case may be. But I feel like that's one of the beauties of a Jerry Byrne defense is that they try to make everybody have to be good at pretty much everything. And if you aren't, then you can't necessarily exploit some of the kind of chinks in the armor that are meant to be exposed. Because, you know, another thing he said is you can't prioritize everything, so you got to prioritize some things. And if you're prioritizing a six-man collective unit and giving those seams to be attacked off ball in order to support on ball or whatever the case may be, then you're ideally, I guess, like turning some dodgers into off-ball finishers. Some guys are better at doing that than others. Nick Kaviri obviously was on Saturday.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that you call out the variety of goals, because one of the things that I think was so impressive about learning that, Byrne method defense was there's not going to necessarily be one specific offensive motion, one player that will beat you. It will be the effect of the player on the unit. And so as we talk in relation to Coulter Mackesy and his ability to draw, you have to be a good off-ball player. One of the first things that he told me was like, Nick, you can be a fine player on ball, but you're not allowed to play until you understand how to play in the context of our defense. Meaning we put a priority on the recovery. We put a priority on the communication of the recovery. How quickly can we slide and recover? And how do we do a good job of applying pressure to the hands during those kind of vulnerable moments as a defense? And I think what Mackesy does really well, and I haven't watched the entire film, I've only seen some clips here and there, but when you have an offense that can draw attention, but take advantage of that in a couple different ways, like your IQ as a defensive player kind of grows over the course of the game. Okay, so when they initiate from X and dodge this way, they're looking for a skip up top as opposed to a skip to the crease. And what I think Princeton does really well, and in relation to, you know, whoever happens to have a good day, in this case Kaviri, he's finding the holes in a variety of different ways. So it's not just one motion where it's, okay, we're going to make the pass up top. It's, I can see that they are hedging and they never let individual players beat them. So they're preparing to slide. But as other people kind of hedge down, makes it a little bit tougher, and credit to Princeton for finding those holes.
No question. I think that when it comes to kind of protracting that out and thinking about the Ivy League going forward, you know, you mentioned that there are a ton of games that we're not going to be able to get to. And one of them is Cornell's 18-15 win over Yale. And in addition to that, we're not going to be able to talk about Penn's win over Dartmouth either, which was in a snow globe. We're not going to be able to talk about LIU, who also played in a snow globe. It was insane. There were some really epic scenes all up and down the Eastern Seaboard on Saturday afternoon. But again, like, now it's funny because we're just talking about how your season can hinge so dramatically in a short span of time. You think about Cornell's vibe coming off of a really one-sided loss against Penn State, and then they have an unbelievably emotionally juiced win at Princeton on the 20th anniversary of George Boyardi's passing, and now they have a win over Yale. They're 2-0 in the Ivy League. Their season has shifted on a dime. I think you can make a similar argument for Princeton on a more narrow basis, where they lost that game against Cornell, and then they turn around and get this win on the road at Cambridge, and now feel pretty good about where they're at, you know? So point being that seasons have their own momentum, and one of the teams that we're also not going to talk about is Johns Hopkins, who just closed out a 13-8 win over Rutgers. think about how they're feeling 1-0 in the Big Ten relative to how they were feeling a week ago coming off of a bad loss at home against Navy in a non-conference game. So there's just so much volatility on a week-to-week basis to this. But Nick, it is time. We have to talk about the game of the week. Can you set the table?
The game of the week, are you kidding me? And we talk about, you know, in the context of how do you bounce back. And the game of the week was undoubtedly Boston beating number one Army. And we talked about High Point beating UNC for the first time in program history. This was the first time that Boston took down the number one team. And it's their first win against the number one program, but especially stringing together three pretty impressive, obviously Army being the cherry on top wins after dropping it to Navy. You know, really what stuck out to me, 27 of 28 clears while Army went 15 of 20, really leveraging that 10-man ride. You know, there was a scary moment where a BU player went down, ultimately ended up being okay. That always, for me, ruined the rest of the game for me. And Boston showed resilience. They showed toughness. And overall, you know, the 14-9 score is no fluke. And watch out for the Terriers. And Terry, is there anybody joining us from Boston today?
We do. We have Coach Ryan Pulley of the BU Terriers. What, Coach Pulley, how do you feel when the team is referred to as Boston versus BU, Boston U, whatever the case may be? Is it kind of like when Michigan fans call Ohio State Ohio just to get under their skin?
Terry, I'm not from Boston, so it doesn't really bother me that much. You know, we obviously represent the city of Boston, and, you know, it's us and Harvard, but, you know, we have the name to go with it. So I know people at Boston, the university, love when you hear the whole word Boston University. So they actually don't like when you guys write it Boston U. That kind of bothers them. But so it's funny. We actually have to, in our logos, have to say Terrier Lacrosse. We just can't say Boston Lacrosse. So it's just a branding thing. And, you know, it doesn't bother me, but, you know, above my pay grade on that one.
I definitely know that our listeners are super interested in brand guidelines when it comes to talking lacrosse. I did also notice that you left out another team that would stake a claim for representing Boston and has the term college at the end of it. So yeah. Definitely appreciate the shade. Always up for throwing shade at Boston College.
Well, we call them Chestnut Hill University. They're not even in Boston. So
the Merrimack disrespect continues.
Yeah, there you go. Yes.
Let's get to this game. I think Nick nailed it. I think that the 10-man ride, you and I have spoken about it ad nauseum over the course of the last, I don't even know, 10 years, 15 years, whatever the case may be. Probably not that long, 5 years, let's say. But it was – so I actually want to take this back a little bit farther because, you know, one of the things that is so interesting, and Nick and I have talked about it on this show for the last 3 years, is matchups, right? Matchups make fights, and, you know, there's something about the way that Navy matches up against you that gives you guys trouble. There's also something about how the way you guys match up against Army that gives Army trouble, and it manifested in this game, but I also think that there was something about your players, the way that they attacked this game on a Friday night, and they manifested a can't-lose attitude. But before we get into all of that, Nick mentioned James Corcoran taking a scary hit, ambulance on the field. Is there any status that you can share based on, you know, how he's feeling 2 days later?
Yeah, all I want to say is James okay. So appreciate all the well wishes. And James was at practice today, and James doing just fine.
Perfect. So let's dive in, man. What where did this game start? Was it the juice? Was it the matchup? Like, how do you start to dive into why you were successful against the number one team in the country?
I mean, I just have to give all the credit to our players. I mean, we've it's been discussed, and, you know, certainly we had a rough start of our season and high expectations, and had a tough game with Bryant, and they came out and took it to us, and kind of same thing that you alluded to with Navy. You know, gave us trouble, and we've just been trying to find our way. So first I just start with our seniors. We call all of our guys with 1 year left, our fifth years and 6 years, and our you know, true seniors, we call them seniors. You know, we have 15 of them, and we met, as I told Matt, we met for long and had some hard conversations. So it all started, you know, the Monday after Navy, that we had to fix some things. So we got better against Bucknell, we got better against Loyola, And we really started to feel, you know, very much like ourselves again, started to get our swagger back, our confidence back, had a great week of practice. And then we just went in there. We wanted to be on the front foot the whole time. That was our goal, is to, you know, start in the 10-man ride, establish ourselves, you know, certainly be aggressive on offense. Clearing had been an issue the last few weeks. So that was a huge, you know, emphasis. Just looking at Army, they kill you with possession time. They kill you with, you know, they face off at a great rate. They were clearing the ball at 90%. They're a good riding team. So if you're not careful, you know, you're negative 15 in a possession game. So that was really critical to us. You know, they're great at the X. And we thought, you know, a way for us to kind of combat that was to have a great riding game. And Coach Filippo, who's taken over the responsibility of our ride, has kind of taken it to the next level. We're executing at such a high level, you know, dealing with different things that people throw at us, staying aggressive in all three of our levels. And then, you know, guys just making plays and making the right read. So just really impressed with the way we rode Army and some of the plays we made on the back end.
And so it's interesting because every time, you know, you mentioned that Bryant kind of took it to you, I would say that it was pretty clear that you took it to Army in this game. And there are a number of ways in which you can do that. Obviously the 10-man ride that you just pointed out, but there also is like, I remember there were a couple times we're going to take it to him and I go out and immediately get like a 2-minute non-releasable. So right. Was there any point where you were like, let's go take it to them? But was there an area where you were like, let's be strategic about it outside of the ride? I love hearing the coach's perspective on this.
Well, we say take it to them. We focus on two things, and that's our compete level. And that is just, we don't want anybody to play harder than us. And when you go against the military academies, you know, both them and Navy, those guys are programmed and taught to just, you know, never quit and have such a high level of compete that you really do have to raise your game. So, you know, I thought we were ready to go, and then it comes down to execution. So we were able to play and compete at a super high level. You know, credit to our seniors again for having us prepared, having a presence in that warm up and being ready to go from the first face off. And then we just had to execute. I mean, you can be playing hard as you want, but if you're not executing, you know, it's really hard to go against such a quality team like Army. So I'm just proud of our guys for how hard we played and the level that we executed at. To go back to your original question, though, I do think, you know, we had to be smart on offense. You know, when you get those turnovers in the 10-man ride, sometimes, you know, the tendency is like, okay, they're scrambled and let's push that. But we felt if we could possess the ball and then kind of shorten the game a little bit and work their defense and tire out their defense, you know, we thought that would be beneficial for us. So once we did get the turnovers in the ride, a lot of times we didn't push transition. We just settled the ball down and took another 60-80, which we thought was in our benefit.
And looking at your schedule, you have Duke coming up. Again, kind of more of like a coaching philosophy question. And drawing on my own experience, anytime we were coming off a big win, it was very quick to say, hey, that win doesn't matter. It's in the past. And as a player, I was always like, yeah, but, it, you know, it kind of does matter. That was a sick win, and I kind of want to pat ourselves on the back. And, you know, going from confident to cocky, kind of finding that level. So how much do you say, like, hey, that was an awesome win. You know, we're a great program that can compete with anyone in the country versus that win's in the past. We got to focus on ourselves and get ready to prepare.
We have a pretty clear cutoff date, and it's usually Monday. We spend Monday working on, you know, we review film. We work on things at practice that we didn't do as well on the weekend and things that we think might help us in the following game. But this week's a little wacky with playing on Wednesday. We played Friday night and then we play on Wednesday. So, you know, today we were still watching Army film. Like, we have kind of made, and it's been good for us. You know, certainly Duke's a great team and Army's a great team. I don't want to take anything away from us. But the most important thing for us over the last couple of weeks is just getting better and sticking to our process and competing in practice and executing the things that we need to execute. Because at the end of the day, teams are going to, you know, they're going to do things. They're going to do things that we haven't seen. They're going to do things that we don't expect. And we need to be at a point where we can adjust and execute against anything. So if we put a ton of time into their, you know, preparation for them and then they change everything, we need to know how to adjust. So we really focus on, you know, us getting better. And then, you know, certainly we'll turn our attention to Duke tomorrow as we start preparing. But they're a wonderful team, had a big win today, and, you know, have all the respect for Coach Janowski and his staff.
I want to get to the offense, but before we do, just a little bit more on the defense. So there are two guys on your team that I think are really well known. Roy Meyer, I personally feel like I've been driving the bandwagon on the Roy Meyer train for 3 years at this point. He had 7 ground balls and a cause turnover. And Patrick Morrison, who is pretty high up a lot of PLL draft boards. But Dane DeGoler, and not just the contributions that he made, but also a couple of kind of uncommon contributions. Because you know, I tweeted out a sequence kind of mid-late fourth quarter where he made a save, right? So he jumped in the goal, and then Will Barnes jumped back in and made 2 more saves. And my comment was, I think it was a 2-goal game at that point, maybe a 3-goal game. And it was just like, if you're Army and you don't score in this situation when you have 3 shots on the doorstep in a kind of not quite, but mostly empty net scenario, it's like, you might as well raise the white flag. You're not going to win that game. But the amount of energy that Dane DeGoler brings is palpable. Can you just kind of speak to him? And then if you've got a little bit more wind in your lugs, I'm also interested in what you have to say about Connor Kemp, because he's another one. It's not, for me, in that situation, it's not as much about the energy, it's about the physicality. But the point is that, like, you've got this depth of contributors defensively that feels like there's a lot of versatility within the group. They kind of fill different roles, and it's not that they're meshing, so to speak, it's that they fit really nicely together so that they don't even have to mesh. They kind of all complement each other.
Well, Dane's one of the most underrated players in the country, and he's been doing it for 3 years at a super high level, and deservedly so. Roy gets a ton of credit. He makes a ton of plays. He's a fantastic player, and Morrison is right there with him. But Dane he quarterbacks our defense. He makes all the right reads, and he's a stat filler. He gets ground balls. He calls his turnovers. He blocks shots. Does all the little things, and he's fearless. I mean, you didn't even talk about the save he made in the first quarter where, you know, one of their players shot the ball from 30 yards out and he's diving in front of the goal. And I'm not joking. He probably has 6 or 7 saves in his career. He's fearless. He understands it. And it's not luck because he does it all the time. But the play that he made, the Army that you referred to, Army had a 2-on-0, and there's a picture of it on the internet where Dane looks like a goalie. I mean, he is standing there squared up to the goalie, and he made a save. He legit made a save. So Dane was huge, and he also just did a great job on the attack when he was guarding. He makes plays. You know, we call them chips when you get him in there. That last poke to force a bad pass or to challenge a shot. Dane's great at that. He's just a really fundamental player, and I'm glad he's being noticed. And Connor's the same way. I would say Connor's kind of built in that same cloth of, you know, kind of underestimated, underappreciated, but he does all the right things. He's a great communicator. And Connor's poised to kind of take over the reins as our quarterback and communicator once Dane graduates.
Underestimated, underappreciated. Yeah, never heard that associated with anybody from Boston before. I mentioned that I wanted to ask about the offensive end. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of BU offenses over the last 5-ish years is just how spread out the contributions are. And you saw it again. I think that there were 9 guys, maybe 10, that got into the box score. And, you know, Lou Perfetto had a goal and 3 assists. And you know, that level of facilitation was really important. How do you assess the offensive performance when you put up 14 on a defense like Army?
Yeah, I mean, it all starts with Coach Lippo. Pound for pound, money, my money, he is the best offense coordinator in the country. He does things. He puts in his own offensive culture. And we have a team culture. And then just Mike is so good at getting his players to be unselfish and to share the ball and to space the field. You know, he is constantly emphasizing offensive spacing and doing the right thing and sharing the ball. And, you know, his 6 hands mentality is something that, you know, really resonates with the offensive guys, and you can see the success on the field. And he empowers his guys. He empowers his guys to make the plays that are necessary to beat a team like Army. You know, you could go in there and say, hey, we got to hold the ball. You're number one. And that was not, our plan. Our plan was to go in there and dodge hard and draw slides from a team that doesn't like to slide. And then take advantage of the opportunities that we're giving ourselves. I give a lot of credit to the midfield. We were able to win our matchups there. Tommy Bork, Thomas Niedringhaus, Cates and Lipton all, you know, had individual goals that Army forces you to do that. They don't slide that much. They force you to win your one-on-one matchups, and those guys did an awesome job of doing that. But the spacing on the field was the reason why that was so effective.
And then one more for me. So, you know, we've talked about the clear, and I would say, you know, one of the bright spots for Army was at the faceoff. You know, they ended up going 17 of 26, I believe. And what's interesting about that is, you know, I was even talking about it on a broadcast, but being able to win in a variety of different ways. And so you lose the battle at the X, but you win the battle in the ride and clear. Is that something that you'll be able to kind of draw on over the course of the season? Is like, hey, it doesn't matter if we're losing the faceoff. It doesn't matter kind of what's happening. We have the tools to win in a variety of ways. Or is it kind of more, hey, let's really lean into this 10-man ride and make that our identity?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know, certainly we want to improve at the faceoff X, and Coach Moreland is working hard with our entire unit and our wing, and I'm very optimistic that we will do that. But both in the Navy and Bryant game, we lost the majority of the faceoffs, and I think that kind of, you know, we weren't blaming the faceoff unit, but it really kind of took the wind out of us. And we kind of talked about it as a coaching staff and to our team, is we can still win the game. And that's why our 10, we put a re-emphasis on a 10-man ride. We put a re-emphasis on, you know, this possession battle outside of the faceoff X. And in order, you hit it right on the head. If you're losing faceoffs, the only real way to kind of take away from that huge advantage is to win the ride and clear game. And that's something that we focus on. We have a really high percentage goal each and every game. And for the last three games, we've really hit that and, you know, been able to, if we're not winning faceoff, to, you know, take away a little bit from that possession advantage.
Coach Pauly, we'll get you out of here on this one. And I am very cognizant of the fact that this might sound like running home to mom to ask her to stop the bullies on the schoolyard from being mean to you. But your alums lit my Twitter mentions on fire on Friday night. And I am not asking you to tell them to stop. I want to be very clear about that. I want you to tell your alums that I am as day one Boston University men's lacrosse as it gets. There are very few people who are in a better position to say that than you are. Can you confirm that I'm a day one Terrier?
I certainly can confirm that. I don't know if you keep picking against us if they're going to stop.
That's what it is.
So I think it's more that than anything. So, and I think calling out Roy on Athletic when he came and visited us, I think that also got him going too. So it was, I will confirm Terry has been, you know, a huge proponent of this program from day one. And, it's been a real good friend. And, you know, I know you got a lot of love for the Terriers, but you know, the boys like when you pick us for sure.
Good to know. All right. Well, we got a big one coming up on Wednesday. I'll let you get back.
Yeah, we sure do. Okay, guys. Thanks. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Coach. Boy, the most hated man in all of Boston, Terry Foy. Who would have thought?
It's like Whitey Bulger and then me.
Whitey Bulger, Derek Jeter, and then you, yeah. I think. Yeah. We'll make that.
I can bear heavy crosses, man. It's all good.
Good on you. So we briefly touched, and Coach joined us kind of as we were going through a little bit of that sampler platter. Are there any other games that you think noteworthy, any other, you know, kind of conference storylines that, our loyal fans should be following?
That's a good question. I feel like I got put on the spot.
Oh, yeah, I did kind of spring it up.
I mean, Ohio State almost beat Penn State. They were like on top of them for like the entirety of like the first three quarters of the game. And then I think Penn State kind of, I wasn't able to watch any of it, and I will catch up on it after this podcast, but important kind of comeback for the Nittany Lions, because if they had dropped that one, I mean, it would have sent the Big Ten into chaos. It would have sent the top 20 into chaos. Who knows what would have happened? Their chickens would have been running up and down the streets. I don't know why I use that, but.
Yeah, I mean, for me, boy, do I hope everybody vote Virginia number one this week. I don't want to see Notre Dame number one. That's always the worst week of practice. Oregon would be, you know, hey, who do you guys think you are? You think you're so good reading all these articles? And I'm like, Coach, I didn't read any article.
I was watching college basketball.
I was watching Trailer Park Boys in college basketball. Please don't make me run okay on the end line. And getting caught up on homework, for sure.
Correct.
So.
Dude, we're basically halfway. We're like halfway done, which is crazy because I definitely feel like I'm out of gas. So.
I was talking to my broadcast partner, Cooper, Perkins. We hit a wall last week, and this weekend gave us a little bit of juice. It was a great Seals game, palpable energy in the arena. And we were kind of leaning into the idea that we're like, yeah, you know, hatred's kind of a good thing. Cause sometimes, you know, I'm getting on this flight and I'm like, I hate this flight. You know, what am I doing? And so now I'm leaning into that and I'm ready to go for the rest of the season. A nothing burger weekend, psych, one of the better weekends we've had all season. And I got a full tank. I went to the petrol station. I went to get gas. I didn't do it in California because my God, those are crazy prices. As soon as I landed back in Boise, went and refueled the tank. So if you need me to carry you, I can carry you for the entire rest of the season.
Wow, what an offer. Well, I don't think I'm going to need it. I'm just going to need to find my hate. I'm going to have to find my inner hate.
Pick against Boston and then just read your DMs from what I'm hearing.
Oh my goodness, what a note to end on. Nick Ocello, that'll do it for another edition of the Tailgate Podcast. This was a good one. We're on a roll. We're on a Boston University-esque roll. Three in a row at least.
Three in a row at least. Pray for Texas A&M's basketball program for my mental sanity for this week. And I love you, Terry.
Love you more, Nick.